discreet, elfin young woman appeared carrying a telegram on a silver plate. Amelia opened the envelope, expecting a confirmation from Albany that all was well. Bonnie and David dead in blizzard. Emma and Claire missing. Delayed in informing you in hope of finding them. All hope now gone. We are heartbroken. We'll bury at thaw. Sending our deepest love. The mulberry trees in the Tuileries, just budding, blurred, as if they had been drowned in a deluge. Amelia put a hand to the arm of the chair, tried to get up, sat back down again.
Madame?
Bonnie. And the girls. Oh, the girls. And David. How will I tell Elizabeth? Amelia said. Flavie knelt beside Amelia, her black dress puddling on the lush threads of the Turkish carpet.
Et vous malade, madame?
Amelia couldn't find the words in French, though Flavie was right. She did feel ill. Emma and Claire. They're so little.
Petite. Qui, madame?
Who? Flavie was still holding Amelia's hand when Elizabeth unlocked the apartment door, her rosewood violin case tucked under her arm. She removed her gloves and set them on the marble-topped table by the door, then looked up.
Grandmama? What is it, Grandmama? What's the matter?
Elizabeth sank into the chair opposite and set the violin case at her feet, her gray eyes widening. The pale afternoon light fell across the smooth skin of her face. Sometimes Elizabeth's beauty struck Amelia with such force that she forgot how young she was. At 17, she lacked the showy twinkle of velvet eyelashes or rose-splashed cheekbones, but she unfailingly brought to mind a Botticelli or a Da Vinci, or sometimes her deceased mother. Darling, Amelia said. She was measuring her words. Bonnie and David. Mary has written. Elizabeth went white.
What?
How careful Amelia had always been in matters of death, to leave mothers of stillborns in her care under no illusions. But what other way was there to tell the news? The O'Donnells were gone. Lizzie, darling, Bonnie and David have died.
What? No.
I don't know the particulars. It's something to do with the blizzard.
They died?
Yes.
When?
During the storm, I think. Elizabeth absorbed the news with a stillness that terrified Amelia. Her granddaughter lifted a gaze turned dull and unseeing.
But Emma and Claire, are they all right?
Aunt Mary and Uncle William have them. Amelia hesitated.
Tell me, Grandmama.
I am told they are lost.
Lost.
Amelia handed Elizabeth the telegram, which she still held in her hand. After reading it, Elizabeth looked up and said again,
Lost?
Within a week, Elizabeth reported that she had negotiated a leave of absence from the conservatoire, and within another week, Amelia had booked their passage on the SS France of the General Transatlantic Company at Le Havre, bound for Manhattan City, to arrive on April 12th. Just before boarding, Amelia sent a telegram to Mary and William from the dingy steamship offices on the Windy Quay at Le Havre, informing them to expect their arrival in Albany on Sunday, April 13th, on the 12:55 New York Central Express without fail. Later that night, as the steamship plowed through the choppy gray waters of the English Channel, the hum of the indefatigable twin screws reverberating through their small cabin, Amelia would not admit to herself that she had waited until their plans were irreversible to telegraph. She had no doubt that had Mary been chaperoning Elizabeth in Paris, her stalwart daughter would have refused the girl's petitions to return home, naming perseverance and courage and dedication as reasons to stay. But Amelia was not Mary. She had known too much grief in her lifetime not to understand that Elizabeth's inconsolable sorrow over the loss of the O'Donnells was too much for her now. The girl had changed. Something unknowable had rendered this once devoted musician utterly indifferent to her once all-consuming passion. Asleep now in the small bed in the alcove of their cabin, Elizabeth looked so much like her deceased mother that Amelia, observing Elizabeth from her vantage point at the porthole window, had to grip an armchair to keep herself upright. Amelia would never stop missing Jenny. Dead now 17 years, would never forget the hours of her daughter's complicated labor that had overwhelmed even her expertise. Ironically, Elizabeth, whose birthday they had recently marked with a sugary cake from the tiny bakery in the Palais Royal, had been born during a blizzard that had delayed a more gifted Mary from getting to her twin sister's bedside to deliver her until it was too late. Amelia thought now how much she despised winter. She wiped fresh tears from her eyes. This was how people kept on, wasn't it? You got on with things. If you wallowed in remembrance, every day was a crucible in which your past exploded into your present. It was how she managed to rise from her bed every morning. Why she forgave everyone nearly everything. At 60, half the people she had loved had left her. Her son Christian, her daughter Jenny, her husband Nathaniel. She lived now for what was, not for what had once been. After all, what was growing older but a reminder of the loss of everyone you had ever loved? But losing Bonnie, too, and those darling girls, was more than she thought she could bear. For Elizabeth's sake, Emma and Claire had been like little sisters to Elizabeth. Mary would have been wrong to deny Elizabeth this break for grief. The conservatoire, the violin, could wait. In late summer, surely no later, they would return to Paris, and a refreshed Elizabeth would resume her march toward excellence. Exhausted, Amelia washed her face, snuffed the oil lamp, and settled against the pillows, just as the ship entered the open sea. Chapter 4. The 12:55 express pulled into the New York Central Railroad depot at Albany with a burst of steam, trailing soot and dirty clods of snow. Mary and William searched the windows of the cars for Amelia and Elizabeth, but all was chaos and disruption as a flurry of porters and passengers converged on the platform. William climbed on top of a crate and spied his mother-in-law and niece waiting sensibly by a pillar near one of the depot doors, calmly surveying the crowd while passers-by took surreptitious note of the curved line of Elizabeth's hat and the trim tidiness of Amelia's bustle. Parisian finery in Albany was rarely seen, and the two had not yet donned mourning, having had no time in the haste of leaving to order a black dress from the seamstress or to dye one of theirs. Amelia folded Mary into her arms as if Mary were the one returning from a long trip, and Mary surrendered to the maternal affection with a convulsive shudder. Only a mother, Mary thought, could render a grown woman or man a child again, even if only for a moment. Mary pulled away and embraced her mother in turn. Grief had diminished Amelia. Her gray locks had escaped their pins. Creases lined her pale face, and her eyes had hooded and wrinkled with age. "You shouldn't have come, Mama, but I'm so glad to see you. Bonnie was as much a daughter to me as she was sister to you, and Elizabeth couldn't stay away. What is the news? Mary shook her head, unwilling to lay out the particulars at the crowded depot, or before Elizabeth, who was weeping quietly on William's shoulder. He unbuttoned his topcoat and reached into his vest pocket for a handkerchief. Elizabeth broke from his embrace to turn to Mary with a defensive, questioning glance, leading Mary to wonder whether Elizabeth had overheard her admonition that they ought not to have come. Mary had questioned their return, and did still, for the reason that Elizabeth would suffer the same grief in Paris as in Albany, but there she could keep up her studies, while here she would be mostly idle, and far more susceptible to the ravages of sorrow, reminded everywhere of the O'Donnells' deaths. Still, it was lovely to see them, and she took her sister's child into her arms. As happened from time to time, Mary, like her mother, caught sight of her twin sister's ghost lurking in Elizabeth's sublime features. The resemblance always startled her, but though Elizabeth's cheeks might be more plump than her mother's and her lashes less full, she still resembled her mother so much that Mary sometimes felt haunted. Elizabeth yielded only slightly to Mary's embrace before pulling quickly away. "Of course you're tired," Mary said. "Harold is waiting with the carriage." That night, they took refuge around the oak dining table, long ago sandwiched into the small nook off the kitchen so that Mary could have the dining room as her clinic. They were contemplating a curl of steam rising from a soup tureen that the insistent Vera had deposited in the middle of the table next to a cobalt-blue teapot. Candles flickered, lit by Vera, though outside a fine spring gloaming hovered. It was soothing to be taken care of, to bask in the shafts of evening light streaming through the window, to sip strong Russian caravan tea, and to fortify themselves with Vera's meaty borscht. Outside, an early thrush was trilling from a leafless branch of the maple tree, while in the kitchen, the oven door screeched as it opened, a hint of cinnamon wafting in the air. Vera had baked an apple pie from last autumn's cellared fruit. Why was it, Mary thought, that beauty and horror always met side by side, magnifying one another? To protect Elizabeth, Mary and William blurred the specifics as they told of their search, but the hoped-for salutary effect failed.
"I should never have gone," Elizabeth said.
"To Paris?" Mary said. "Of course you should have."
"No, I should have waited. The conservatory could have waited. Going was such a mistake."
"My darling girl," William said, "you could not have known what would happen. We wanted you to go. Bonnie wanted you to go. She was so proud of you. You could not have predicted such a storm."
"But I would have had more time with them. Instead, I wasted my time. How can you say that?"
"You didn't waste anything," Mary said. Elizabeth ignored her.
"What time do we begin looking tomorrow? I'll help."
Mary glanced at William, who shook his head at her, but Mary pressed.
"Looking?" "For Emma and Claire."
"But we've already looked everywhere. We did everything we could."
"But we have to keep looking. They could be anywhere."
Mary recalled Captain Mantell's harsh words, his dismissive, mocking tone when she had uttered the same protestations.
"I know it's hard to accept. It was for us, too. But we, and the police, we've looked every single place they could be. 2, 3 times."
"Bonnie and David would never stop searching," Elizabeth said.
The pronouncement came as a slap across Mary's face, echoing her own vow of just a few weeks ago.
"I know this is difficult, but when you go back to Paris," Mary said, "you might find that..."
"I'm never going back."
Mary glanced at Amelia.
"That's just the grief speaking.
Don't abandon. You don't understand, Elizabeth said. You're good at everything, but I am a failure.
William met Mary's eyes and again shook his head. But Mary couldn't let the girl believe such an outrageous thing.
No, you're not. Your grandmother's letters were full of news of your achievements.
Elizabeth jumped from her seat and threw down her napkin.
That is always what you say. You always say we did everything that we could. You always say don't turn your back on your gift.
Lizzie, what is the matter? But the girl swept past Mary and up the back stairs, her footsteps clattering on the polished wood. Amelia reached an unsteady hand across the table to Mary.
Did she just say that she quit? Mary said. She told me she obtained leave of absence. Did you verify that?
No, I didn't, Amelia said, drawing herself up.
I didn't check up on her because I don't check up on anyone. I am not the one enrolled in the conservatory. Something has been bothering her. She hasn't been herself lately. When your telegram came, I was already thinking she ought to get away.
William looked on, loath to intervene between mother and daughter.
But did you know what she'd done? Mary said. I didn't, but as Lizzie said, everyone is not you. Leave her be.
With a great swish of her wide skirts, Vera came clucking into the room with a fragrant pie, her hands swathed in a towel against the hot pan. She set the pastry before them and stood back. Taking in their glum faces at a glance, she muttered something indecipherable in Russian and whisked away the tureen. Returning within moments with the sherry decanter, she distributed 3 crystal glasses, poured far too much into each, and said,
"Drink something."
Chapter 5. The Sutter plot in Albany Rural Cemetery occupied a portion of Bower Hill that overlooked a sparse stand of white oaks and Indian Lake, which had been fashioned from damming Crum Kill, one of the brooks that meandered through the burying ground. It was now 6 weeks since the blizzard, and still the last traces of snow had not melted, but here and there tulips and daffodils had broken through the warming soil and unfurled their tapered greenery and hard buds. And though this late in April ice still blocked the Hudson, another unusual circumstance in this surprising year, the cemetery had sent word that the ground had given away enough to allow burials to begin. Mary was moving among the graves, purging the aging tombstones of stray rhizoids of the delicate, tenacious lichen that clung to the gray slabs. The plot boasted a flowering dogwood, not yet in bloom, under which Christian's and Jenny's gravestones bracketed their fathers. Jenny lay beside her husband, Thomas. A granite statue of 2 entwined cherubs had been placed next to the 2 open graves, into which Bonnie's and David's caskets had already been lowered. Last week, Mary and Amelia had cleaned out the O'Donnell's flat and Bonnie's shop, a bleak task that had plunged them deeper into misery. Lately, everything they did seemed to bear the mark of finality. The minister waited until Mary finished her tidying rounds and joined William, Amelia, and Elizabeth before the open graves. The metallic scent of the upturned dirt played on Mary's tongue, reminding her of the smell of blood, that lingering vestige from the war that had never left her. On the other side of the plot's low picket fence, 2 sweaty grave diggers were leaning on their shovels, waiting for the service to end. The gilt-edged pages of the minister's open prayer book riffled in the cool wind as he began the liturgy. They had placed a notice in the Argus that the graveside service would be private, for they had feared that all of the lumber district would have turned out, including the society women who loved Bonnie's hats, to say nothing of Emma's and Claire's schoolmates. Despite these efforts,
They were not completely alone. Since the war, a new rage for cemetery visits had arisen, out of grief or curiosity, or both. This funereal tourism had the unfortunate effect of intruding on the serenity of mourners everywhere, who unwittingly became part of a pastoral tableau. On any given day, an endless parade of sightseers traversed Albany rural cemeteries, serpentine lanes in their carriages, consulting their Appleton's guides on the monuments and mausoleums of distinction. And today was no exception. To the creak of passing carriages, the minister read the burial service, holding one hand aloft when he bestowed a blessing. During the last prayer, the family threw roses they had purchased at the cemetery greenhouse onto the coffins.
"In sure and certain hope of the resurrection to eternal life, through our Lord Jesus Christ, we commend to Almighty God our brother and sister in Christ, Bonnie and David O'Donnell, and we commit their bodies to the ground. Earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust."
There were no bodies to commit for the girls. For a moment, the minister seemed at a loss. Elizabeth broke into tears. Earlier that morning, when Mary happened on Elizabeth on the veranda, where each had gone in search of a moment alone before the long carriage ride to the cemetery, Mary had suggested that Elizabeth might want to play the violin at the graveside. Since Elizabeth's return 4 days earlier, her instrument had been collecting dust under her bed. Nor had Elizabeth been sleeping since she'd come back. Mary often heard her creep downstairs in the middle of the night, the rasp of the bathroom door as it shut, and an onrush of water splashing in the sink.
"You might find solace in playing," Mary hazarded. "You know how the girls and Bonnie loved."
Elizabeth's retort was sharp, abrupt.
"No, Aunt, I'm out of practice."
Taken aback, Mary directed her gaze across the street, where beyond a wrought iron fence, Washington Park still projected itself as more of an idea than a full-fledged preserve. The land had once housed the city's burying grounds, and at least 40,000 bodies had been exhumed in the 50s and transported to the newly established Albany Rural Cemetery. When finished, the park promised to be a long rectangle of green, its new man-made lake a magnet for recreational boating, and its numerous graveled paths a verdant refuge for a city-weary public. Several acres of the fledgling park boasted decorative parterres for flowers, and dozens of saplings had been planted in the last few years under a pre-existing canopy of older elms and maples, but a good portion of it still consisted of patches of weeds and hillocks of dirt. The city was still reclaiming land. Although its eastern boundary of Willett Street was embroidered with newly built brownstones, down the street, a last line of condemned row houses within the park's boundary awaited demolition. At that very moment, men were gathering with sledgehammers and wheelbarrows, milling about the emptied houses, laying bets on who would make the bricks fall the fastest, their deep voices echoing in the early morning air.
"I said, I'm out of practice!"
Mary turned, astonished. This, and last night's belligerence, was out of character for Elizabeth. She could be temperamental, but she was rarely confrontational.
"Lizzie, I know you're heartbroken. I am too. We all are. But what is this about? Did something happen to you in Paris? Is that why you don't want to go back?"
Elizabeth just sighed in response and swept past Mary, slamming the front door behind her as the first blows of sledgehammers dinned in the distance. This, Mary thought, was what came from decades of hearing people utter secrets during labor or the last gasps of a suffocating illness.
I love another man. Another woman. I can't have another child or I'll go mad. My father hurts me. It made Mary believe that people always wanted to confide in her. Now, in the cemetery, sunlight caught the rounded shoulders and wings of the granite cherubs as Elizabeth wept. The minister was frantically turning pages in search of something fitting to say, finding at last a vague prayer of dedication and benediction as they stooped to lay their last roses at the base of the statue. The gravediggers readied their shovels, and the minister offered Amelia his arm to guide the group down the hillside, bearing their grief in the practiced, weary curve of his shoulders. At the bottom of the rise, an open carriage had drawn next to theirs. Standing before it, a diminutive woman was framed by two men, one older and one younger. The younger man bore six enormous bouquets of flowers. As the family approached, the older man came forward, removing a gray top hat to reveal a bald pate.
"We are sorry to intrude, but we saw the notice in the paper. We couldn't stay away. Allow me to introduce myself. I am Garrett Vanderveer."
Although the Stips were well acquainted with Albert Vanderveer, Garrett's distant cousin and a surgeon at Albany Hospital, the Stips had never met Garrett, though of course they knew of him by reputation. In person, there was nothing distinctive about the prominent man, except a hoarse, gravelly voice, no doubt acquired from years of screaming orders into the vast expanse of his lumber lot, and a bulldog stature that belied his wealth. Dressed less richly, he could have been mistaken for a common laborer, but in his beautifully tailored gray frock coat and vest, he looked every inch a gentleman.
"I considered David O'Donnell the best man on my lot. We lost a few men in that blizzard, but we will miss David the most. We are grievously sorry for your loss. Please forgive our tardiness. We would have arrived much earlier, but our horse Dolly threw a shoe. We had to leave her at that traveler's livery on Broadway and exchange her for that sorry beast."
He gestured to a spotted mare harnessed to the polished carriage, and then to the woman at his side.
"This is my wife, Viola, who has told me that Mrs. O'Donnell made the most beautiful hats in Albany. I believe my wife must have spent a fortune in her shop."
One could almost imagine, from the right angle, that Viola Vanderveer was a child playing dress-up. Under her wrap, her shoulders were little more than the width of a pair of hands set finger to finger, and her waist could easily be encircled by one arm. A flat chest had been disguised by a flock of ruffles, meticulously placed and gathered to give the appearance of a bust. Her skin was luminous and unmarked by the sun, and her large, dark eyes were framed with thick, black lashes. The doll-like woman carried a consciousness of her lingering beauty, as beautiful women always did, certain of acceptance, reliant on the kind of favor that they received because of it. But in Viola, that easy, unexpected elegance combined with a hint of juvenile insecurity, making her seem less than what she was, the wife of the wealthiest man in town, and the daughter of one of the richest men in Manhattan City. It was rumored in Albany circles that their engagement had been hasty and their marriage swift, at the behest of Viola's father, a shipping magnate who was eager to marry off his youngest daughter so that he and his wife could finally withdraw from Manhattan's tiresome social scene. It was said that he had discharged his last paternal duty with a booster's admiration for Garrett's ambition, while ignoring his rougher edges. Perhaps that was the reason for the hint of insecurity. But Viola Vanderveer immediately defied Mary's assessment by floating toward them, exuding kindness and concern.
"How do you do?" she said. "Please forgive our family's intrusion. But I adored Bonnie."
She was always so kind to me. She used to put the closed sign on the door, and we would gossip over tea in her back room while she sketched designs for the new season. I miss her so much. She told me how fond she was of all of you. We really ought to have written you when it happened. And we are heartbroken about Emma and Claire. I never got the chance to meet them, but Bonnie never stopped talking about them, so I feel as if I knew them a little. You have our sincerest condolences.
She extended a comforting hand to Mary's wrist before drawing the young man beside her close with a touch to his elbow.
Have you met my son, Jacob?
Jacob Vanderveer was far taller than either of his parents, and his physique was that of a young man who heaved and cut and loaded lumber into ships on the Erie Canal all day long. It had recently been announced in the newspapers that he had graduated from Harvard with a law degree and was working in the yards to learn the trade before he joined his father at the helm of their prosperous endeavor. The article also said that for 3 summers running, starting when Jacob had been 14, his father had sent him deep into the Adirondacks to learn lumbering, even insisting that his workers take Jacob out onto the dangerous log jams on the rivers to teach him how to clear them. He appeared as strong as David O'Donnell had been, and his black frock coat pulled at his wide shoulders. Jacob offered Amelia, Mary, and Elizabeth each one of the large bouquets, which left him still holding 3. The flowers were beautiful, white roses and baby's breath, and several sprigs of freesia against a spray of light greenery, wrapped in tissue paper and tied with black ribbons. This early in the season, he must have gone to a great deal of trouble to obtain them.
"Please accept our sincerest sympathies," Jacob said. "David O'Donnell taught me everything I know about handling lumber. I would have been with him that day, except that I happened to be in the office with my father, going over the books. We were able to get home, unlike... Well, we are sorry."
Regret, or maybe shame, clouded his handsome features. He was apologizing for something over which he had no control, and this kindness endeared him to everyone.
"How kind of you to come," William said, tipping his hat. "I am William Stipp. May I introduce my wife, Dr. Mary Stipp, my mother-in-law, Mrs. Amelia Sutter, and my niece, Elizabeth Fall, and Reverend Miller, our minister."
There were more pleasantries all around, though Elizabeth was keeping to herself, comforted by Amelia, who had one arm around her waist.
"It is a great shame that I never had the pleasure of meeting Bonnie,"
Garrett Vanderveer said.
"Nor those girls. A tragedy to lose those two. The blizzard was a terrible thing. But flood, you see, that's the real danger, especially for lumbermen. It's odd that it's always flood danger and never fire in the district, given the inflammability of our product, but we've been lucky there. No fires. But when a flood comes, losses like no one's business. We're due for a bad one, I think, after that blizzard. My men in the Adirondacks have told me that the snowpack is deep. A few more days of warm weather and it will flood out of the mountains. This won't be a mere freshet either,"
Garrett went on, unaware that everyone was staring at him, taken aback by his odd digression.
"Not like the usual spring flood. This one will be a torrent. It will come to steal our souls. If you own anything of importance near the river, take precautions. We keep to higher ground,"
William said, turning to go, unwilling to endure more talk of disaster. While it was true that spring freshets regularly inundated Albany, Troy, and Watervliet, too, no one wanted to talk of that now. Jacob, sensing William's displeasure, said,
"Of course we won't keep you longer on this difficult day. However, if I may say one more thing..." We are neighbors, are we not? Aren't you the owners of the lovely Victorian across the park from us, on Madison Avenue?
Yes,
William said.
My wife and I work out of the house, too. The famous Dr. Stipp,
Garrett said.
We are hardly famous, Mary said.
You are in some circles,
Garrett said.
Dr. Stipp, with your Medal of Honor, you expect to hide?
William nodded stiffly. He never spoke of it. The honor had come to him after Gettysburg, and because he did not like to be reminded of the war, he kept the medal in its velvet box in a dresser drawer. He wondered how Garrett knew.
And Mrs. Stipp is especially famous, or at least she was in my mother's view,
Garrett continued.
When Dr. Stipp... It's difficult keeping you two separate, isn't it? When Mrs. Stipp, Mary, if I may, left for the war, my mother thought her brilliant.
And Miss Fall, Jacob interjected, before Mary could again deny any hint of fame. Are you not the young violin prodigy? The girl who went to Paris to study?
Elizabeth, who had kept herself apart from the conversation, startled and looked up from her bouquet of flowers, too surprised to say anything.
I thought so, Jacob said, taking her silence as acquiescence. I read about you in the newspapers. And once I heard you play at Tweddle Hall. You were 12, I think. I was 16 then, in awe of your talent. I've not heard anything as beautiful since.
Elizabeth ducked her head and looked away. Thank you.
Have you finished with your studies? Jacob said.
I'm not certain, she murmured, her voice hardly audible. Mary and William traded glances, and Jacob attempted no more compliments. Viola said,
We are aware that you are still in mourning, but couldn't we all become better acquainted? Won't you come to tea or dinner sometime? It needn't be soon.
Her offer seemed as much plea as invitation.
Amelia accepted for all of them, but only after a fashion, murmuring vague thanks without being specific, and expressing gratitude for the flowers. Garrett lifted his hat, as did Jacob, who stole a last glance at Elizabeth before taking his mother by the elbow to follow his father, who was already striding up the hill toward the graves where the impatient gravediggers were at their work. As their driver, Harold, steered their carriage down the lane, Mary looked back again to see Viola and Jacob laying the remaining bouquets at the headstones, and Garrett kneeling, tenderly placing one before the granite cherubs. That night, neither William nor Mary could sleep. The wind had kicked up during dinner, and the maple tree outside was throwing haunting traces in the moonlight. William could see wisps of Mary's silver curls falling across her face. He never tired of the miracle of Mary at his side, the nighttime soft around them, their bed warm with their love. 14 years after the end of the war, 12 since they'd been married, and he still could not believe his good fortune. Nothing else good had come of the war for him, except an expertise in orthopedics, but that was nothing compared to Mary. God, how he loved her. Mary Sutter. Mary Sutter Stipp. He had to remember the Stipp part, because he always thought of her as Mary Sutter. Mary broke the silence, speaking, as she often did, as if William had been privy to the raging conversation in her head. He never minded her habit of assuming that he understood what she had been thinking, because he often did. Her voice caught as she said, What if something else happened? Something unimaginable. It was the first time she'd voiced this darker prospect. She had hedged and gone silent upon leaving every orphanage, had postulated and suggested and wondered.
but she had never before mentioned any outcome besides discovery or death. He himself believed that Emma and Claire were almost certainly dead. Though he too wondered from time to time, waking in the middle of the night to imagine terrible things, achieving sanity again only at dawn. And though Mary had remained calm in the face of Elizabeth's continuing doubts, privately she was unable to lay to rest her own. "What if we are all making an assumption?" Mary said. "What if Emma and Claire are still alive?" Not even two granite angels had silenced the bounding unreason of hope.
"Mary, where would they be? Someone would have found them."
Stalemate. Again. William lifted his gaze and watched the shadows of the maple branches play on the ceiling.
"That Vanderveer boy seemed to be taken with Elizabeth."
"I hope not. She doesn't need another reason to stay in Albany."
"He seems kind enough."
Mary sighed. "She can't give up."
"The girl is suffering,"
William said.
"You must keep in mind how young she is. I think we forget that sometimes."
"She is not that young. And she's on the cusp of greatness. Mother told me that they had rarely seen such promise." To distract his persistent wife from worrying about her niece, William said,
"Garrett and Viola are odd ducks, don't you think?"
"Yes. So odd. And all that babbling about flooding? What was that about? It was good of them to come, though. But do you know that Bonnie never said a word to me about Viola? Which is a little sad, considering that Viola seems to have been so fond of her. I liked her, though. Far more than I liked him. I suspect hidden depths, though I am not sure why." From the hallway came the sound, once again, of Elizabeth padding down the stairs. They heard her up at least once a night, sometimes more, her tentative steps quiet on the floorboards as she endeavored not to wake them. "Tomorrow," Mary said, "I'm going to reopen the downtown clinic. It's Thursday, after all, and those women have nowhere else to go." Downstairs, water ran in the sink, the copper plumbing banging softly in the walls.
"I fear you are tempting fate with that other clinic of yours,"
William said. "No one will find out." "Oh, William, I could not bear seeing those granite angels today," she said, her voice soft against his cheek. "I wish we knew what happened. I'd accept anything, I think. Just know." William believed they would never know. And he did not know how to carry that pain. How to mitigate the not knowing. Not for Mary, not for Amelia, and certainly not for Elizabeth. He lay very still, conscious of the softening rhythm of Mary's breath, the warm cushion of her breasts. For a man who had long ago given up his belief in God, he prayed now that his love would be enough to comfort them all. Chapter 6. In the bedroom across the hall from Mary and William's, Elizabeth Fall returned from using the bathroom downstairs and slid her rosewood violin case out from underneath her bed and unlocked it. Taking care not to pop the single latch for fear of making a telltale noise, she eased it open as the pungent scent of rosin wafted up. Since her return, the violin had languished in its glossy case, the bow buttoned into its leather sheath. Had she possessed the wherewithal, she would have stuffed the cursed thing into the back of the armoire, or better yet, given it away. but such action would have required the resolve that had incinerated in Monsieur Gerard's studio.
"Would you like to play the violin?" Mary had asked.
Elizabeth knew she had sounded like a petulant child this morning, and at the cemetery she had become furious with herself. Emma and Claire had loved to listen to her play, and so had Bonnie. It still seemed impossible that Bonnie and David had died, that Emma and Claire were gone. But what was gone? Gone was not buried. Gone was nothing. And she hadn't even been able to set aside her embarrassment and shame to play for them one last time. In Paris, unknown to Elizabeth, the director of the conservatoire had assigned her to Monsieur Gerard without his consent. She'd been thrilled to study under such a master. But she soon learned that Gerard wasn't happy about being assigned to La Fille Américaine, as he called her. The American girl. Little by little, month by month, he set about stripping her of confidence. In session after session, he complained of her bowing or fingering, or if he were especially irritated, her musicality.
"Oh, for God's sake, don't you feel it? The warmth, the enticement. Give in to it. Oh, at least try. Do this," he would say, placing his hand between her shoulder blades. "Imagine my hand as the sun on the hills of Siena, the blazing scorch of evening light on Italian stucco, the day's lingering warmth in vineyard grapes. No, not that way. You are failing the music, can't you see? Play the piece again, and for God's sake, mind the tempo. It's as if you have just begun playing. Can't you hear the shift in tone?"
Occasionally, he dismissed her from her lesson early with a gesture of disgust. She would never achieve greatness, never communicate the warmth of Rossini, the fluidity of Verdi. She was a disgrace and would never excel. He maintained this assessment, even though she was held up for admiration in her other classes, selected to play in special school concerts, and often praised by the director. But Gerard's was the voice she believed, and still heard. His criticism broke her heart, for from the moment she had first heard the instrument, it had become both love and haven. It was William who had introduced it to her, just after her father died. She had been young, 6 years old when her father succumbed to his war wound, his bed awash with fever and infection. No one knew then that the pressure of the wooden legs on the stumps of amputees would eventually kill them. Once, Elizabeth had asked her father why half his leg was wooden. He'd knocked the golden oak of his right shin and grinned.
"When I was in the war, after Antietam, your clever Aunt Mary saved my life by exchanging my old bad leg for this new wooden one."
Mary later explained to Elizabeth that her father's wound imitated a bed sore, but Elizabeth had had no idea what stealthy trouble that innocuous-sounding ailment posed. It seemed that so many of the medical complications after the war erupted out of nowhere. Fixes that suddenly betrayed, unresolved issues that lingered, then pounced. Infections from embedded, intractable minié balls, digestive impairments that ultimately starved their victims, deformities that hobbled and crippled. Aunt Mary and Uncle William often despaired of these outcomes. Later, too, they would tell her that she became inconsolable when her father died. They were living in Manhattan City then. 6 years old and she wouldn't eat. Not even for Bonnie, whose ministrations rarely failed. So one snowy night, William lifted Elizabeth into the carriage, tucked a traveling blanket around her, told her that a talented woman would play a violin, and that the music would help her to forget her unhappiness. but from the moment the first taps of the kettle drums floated into the auditorium of the Academy of Music, and the violin strains swelled, Elizabeth began to weep and could not stop. Alarmed, her uncle carried her outside, but she cried loudly to be taken back, creating a scene. William returned with her to their seats and held her on his lap, trying to comfort her. Afterwards, she begged to meet the violinist. William fought his way to the proscenium, where Camilla Urso, a French expatriate, stood accepting bouquet after bouquet. Elizabeth held out her hand to be touched. Impressed, Urso invited Elizabeth to visit her the next day in her suite at the Fifth Avenue Hotel. There, a steam lift carried them up 6 floors to a beautiful room full of opulent furnishings and windows that overlooked the avenue.
"I was 7 years old when I first attended the Conservatoire de Paris," Mademoiselle Urso said, offering them each a cup of tea. "You are 7, yes, aren't you, Elizabeth?"
6.
"You are the only other little girl I have ever met who weeps at music. I am the other. But does your weeping mean that you wish to play? Or that you wish only to meet the people who make the music that makes you weep?"
"She is all of 6 years old," William said. "Perhaps she is not yet certain what she wants."
"Ah, but I know desire."
Mademoiselle Urso set her teacup and saucer on the low table between them and coaxed Elizabeth to a corner of the room. She pulled her gleaming violin from its case, put the bow to the strings, and breathed a single thread of beauty into the echoing room. Pachelbel, the canon in D, a tune as evocative and haunting as the night wind. Elizabeth again began to weep.
"Do you see?" Mademoiselle Urso said. "She weeps at nuance. She knows what she wants. Don't you, Elizabeth?"
Elizabeth didn't want nuance, whatever that was. She wanted her father back. But when Mademoiselle Urso played, her grief found comforting expression.
"When Elizabeth has exhausted her teacher's ear, as I know she will, I suggest Paris."
William placed a warm hand on Elizabeth's shoulder.
"But we don't know whether or not she has any aptitude."
This practical objection did not seem to matter to Mademoiselle Urso. She shrugged and said,
"She will play, and she will play well. Now, you must excuse me. I need to begin my practice for tonight, and if I go past 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the napping matrons in the hotel complain."
She kissed Elizabeth on her wet cheek and walked them to the door. Early the next week, Elizabeth began lessons with a teacher at the New York Academy, who, after a year, passed her on to a new instructor when Elizabeth exhausted both his repertoire and skill. Would that Monsieur Gerard had recused himself, Elizabeth thought now. She had written Bonnie about Monsieur Gerard's disparagement, but now Bonnie was gone, and Elizabeth could never tell her accomplished Aunt Mary anything of her failure. And how would Uncle William look at her if he knew the truth about her? In Paris, Elizabeth had tried to tell Amelia, but she had been unable to form the words. Gerard's disapproval had intensified, and Elizabeth had pretended that everything was fine. And then had come the reprieve of the telegram. Even Jacob Vanderveer believed her to be something she wasn't. She flipped shut the lid and snapped the clasp as a final hint of rosin floated in the air. Unable to even think of sleeping, she slipped out into the hallway and again padded down the stairs. Her grandmother was sitting in the dark in the parlor. She gestured to Elizabeth to join her.
Her gray hair was braided down her back, and she wore a warm robe over her nightgown that felt soft as Elizabeth laid her head on her shoulder.
You haven't been sleeping, have you, Lizzie?
No.
You weren't toward the end in Paris either, were you?
Elizabeth shook her head.
Do you want to tell me what the matter is?
She shook her head again.
It's very hard, Amelia said. I know how much you loved Bonnie and David and the girls. I did too. Some days I can hardly breathe thinking of everyone we've lost. But you must try to live, if you can. Do you see?
Elizabeth felt tears welling in her eyes. No.
But darling, you must at least try. Will you promise me?
I can't. Elizabeth's voice broke. I don't know what to do.
Practice, Amelia said. Practice being alive.
Practice being alive, Elizabeth said.
Yes, if you can, try.
Please?
Can you do that?
I don't know, Elizabeth said, and got up and left the room without another word. Chapter 7. In truth, Albany's architectural elegance was concentrated only on State Street and around the Capitol building, the vistas that dominated postcards and guidebooks. Since the war, a denser, homelier hodgepodge of 5- and 6-story brick and clapboard buildings had mushroomed on the lesser streets running up from the river and away from the Grand Central Boulevard. Down one of these dank, narrow alleyways, just a stone's throw from the elegant Delavan House, the premier hotel in the city, Mary had rented a forlorn room in a marginal state of repair, where on Thursday mornings she treated Albany's prostitutes. She had started the practice when they returned from Manhattan City, when she realized that every hospital in the city, including City Hospital, where she and William were on staff, turned prostitutes away from their doors, even when they were in dire need, and especially if they were suffering from a botched abortion. Mary did not perform that procedure, even when the women begged, but she offered to deliver their babies, and frequently did. But because the police considered offering care to a prostitute aiding and abetting a criminal, Mary was the only doctor in Albany who would treat them. The clinic's only advertisement was a diminutive red cross that she affixed above the door outside, small enough not to draw the eye, but large enough to be a signal to those in the know. Mary was certain the International Red Cross would not mind the appropriation. After all, Mary believed her client suffered the same need as did any soldier of war. The room boasted 2 windows situated high enough to block the view of anyone passing. She had partitioned off a part of the room with a burlap curtain to provide at least the illusion of privacy, a foreign commodity to the women she served. Furnished simply, the room contained several chairs, an exam table, an instrument cabinet, and a wide table set next to the rudimentary sink, into which she had plumbed a line at some expense. The new faucet piped river water, which needed boiling to thwart typhoid, so she kept 2 kettles simmering at all times on the coal stove. On Thursdays, Mary always arrived at 8:30 to light the stove, boil the water, and resupply her stash of carbolic soap and clean towels before she opened at 9. But today she arrived much earlier, for just as she had feared, her long absence after Emma's and Claire's disappearance had caused the room to go to must. Surveying the exposed brick of the walls, she discovered a cluster of roaches nesting in a damp corner. After battling these with the business end of a broom, she scrubbed the rough stone floor, dusted away cobwebs, and wiped down everything with a soaped rag, even climbing on a chair to wash a film of grime from the high window.
But no matter how primitive this clinic was, it still surpassed the facilities of the Union Hotel Hospital during the war, where she had had